Hello, welcome back to the History Sibyl. And in this episode, we're going to be continuing with another extract from Women, Power, and Danger, which is one of the chapters in my long in the future forthcoming book, The Sorcery Charge, and part of a series called Secret History of the Witches. And so I want to look, this is one of the most detailed accounts that I've been able to find from this time period in the 1300s, the later 1300s, of some witch trials that are very much bound up with sexual politics, as you'll see. I don't need to explain that. But just as a prelude, there were secular judges. This is not the Inquisition here that we're looking at in the city of Paris. These judges are presiding over some pivotal French trials in the 1390s. And the theological busybodies from the University of Paris were closely involved in this. At the time, the Sorbonne was embarking on its golden age of demonology. And, you know, there's a base there in scholasticism. But over several centuries, more and more witch ideology, demonology, all of that, with influence from the Inquisition, is making its way into their thinking. And so the provost of the Châtelet de Paris, this is the main jail in Paris, called in experts from the Faculty of Law at the Sorbonne. And they were there to assess the testimony of an accused witch in 1390. So there's a woman named Marion Lestalet, and she seems to have a good reputation. She had a nickname, La Droiturière, the upright or the righteous. And she had been arrested along with Margot de la Barre, whose nickname was Coignet, Quince. And this older woman was a madam who traveled around with several women in the sex trade. So both of these female defendants were originally accused of sorcery that caused a newlywed couple to become ill. And as by this time was already procedural, we see torture being brought in. And so old Margot, the madam, was subjected to water torture and the rack. And the criminal register admits that she was much crippled and weakened, but still she adamantly refused to, quote unquote, confess. And about 3 weeks later, the judges also brought in Marion to the torture, and she too denied these accusations of witchcraft. But then, of course, this is how all these stories go. The executioner ties her to the rack and was ready to begin torturing her yet again. And the courage of Marion failed her at last, and she agreed to confess, put that in quotes. So she spins out a story to the judges. Very hard to really evaluate the truth of anything being told under torture. Some kind of story has to be told that is going to please the judges, or it continues. But she said, well, I loved Hanselin Planiette, and this lover deserted her after he had announced that he was going to marry another woman, Agnès Sot. And there may have been a class difference here between these women. You know, he was going to make a more favorable union. That seems to get a whiff of that. Marion seems to be like a working class girl here. And so she tells the judges that she had gotten Margot to make her an herbal potion to bring back her lover. And so this is not uncommon to see women in the sex trade engaging in various kinds of magic like this. So that's in line with what we know from other sources. But this potion failed. He didn't come back to Marion. And so the two of them threw, she says, a magical herbal wreath under the bride and groom's feet during their wedding. And this was the aim of preventing the marriage from being consummated. And so here we have the dreaded magic of male impotence surfacing again. And I made some references to that in the previous episode. So court officers confront Margot with the confession of Marion. And this is, remember, the old woman is still saying, nope, nope, not going to say what you want under torture. And so Margot denies the story and in some desperation offers to settle the issue by the ordeal of battle. So she's reaching back to these old feudal customs, anything she can do, really, to get out of the torture and out of the inevitability of being burned at the stake. But, of course, the judges were not going to allow a common crone to have the privilege of a gentleman of having trial by combat, or a lady, for that matter, you know, using a proxy. Margot had alibis, and her witnesses were no help to her. What she was saying was simply not going to be accepted. So finally, realizing that there was no point to enduring more torture, since her case was already decided in the minds of the judges, Margot assented to the story that Marion had told under torture. She had invoked a demon to empower magic wreaths. So the judges unanimously imposed the death penalty on the old woman. But before being executed, she had to be placed in the pillory where the public would be able to stare, catcall, throw stones, sewage, garbage at her, and then she would be burned alive. The judges had some disagreement about the sentence for the younger woman. Some wanted only to pillory and banish her. And the majority, however, wanted to burn her too and sent Marion to the stake 2 weeks after Margot. And this business of pillorying and banishing, a lot of the evidence we have, and there's more of it, of course, for later periods, but we see a common pattern where a woman would be accused several times before she was actually sent to the stake. And so she could be branded, she could be imprisoned, fined, exiled, all kinds of punishments were in play, not just being burned alive. So the two of those two women are burned. Now, the second trial is not in Paris, but it was going on at the same time, where another witch burning was ordered by the abbot of Saint-Chaffre in Vély. And here, he's not acting as a church authority in the sense that, you know, he is of the church, but he's the church as a feudal landlord, as a feudal lord. And so he's the old justicier, he's the feudal lord in charge of all judicial judgments. So here, our story begins with a traveling wise woman. And she had a successful healing practice in the area and was being consulted for a whole variety of cures and remedies. And her name was Jeannette Neuve-Rivergarde. She was poor. She came from Auvergne, so an outlander. And she healed with words and breuvage, so brewings or drinks. This is potions again. Herbal teas, we could say, or decoctions. And she had the medical side there going on, but she also sent her patients very often to local shrines as part of the treatment. So this is holistic. And we can imagine that these might have been springs and stones which had been reputed to have healing power since ancient times. There's a lot of reference to this in older sources. And I talk about this in my book, Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, for the period of 700 to 1100. Their church sources are already telling us that people are doing this back in that period. So Jeannette won some renown to the point where a nobleman came to consult her. And this was the Sire de Bourget, who had quarreled with his wife. This is not really healing as much as it was sorcery that he wanted. And we don't really know what was going on between him and his wife. What does quarrel mean? But anyway, he wanted a potion from Jeannette, and she gave him one, and he later died. So she was accused of having poisoned him and of other things. And this is a common pattern also, where you have a woman who's a healer who is subject to suspicion because she is seen as a woman of power. And so, you know, she could be blamed for anything that went wrong. in their patients' lives. So one of the charges that was brought against her was that she was friends with Jeannette de Folland, another sorcière of public fame. So reputation is really important here. Once it gets around that you are a witch, then that puts you in greater danger. And the older you get, the more likely it is that something that's going to, serious is going to be done to you because of it. So here we have the final story, but there's not a lot of detail in this one. Levalgarde was burned by order of the Abbey's manorial court. So here we are again. It's a monastery, and the abbot as judicial lord is having her burned. Here's another trial, and this involves the Bishop of Meaux in the north, and Jean de Brigue is sentenced to a year in prison for witchcraft. This is in 1389. And so when she was released, and see, again, you see that's not a super severe, I mean, you could die during that year because somehow food has to be gotten to, and you could die of disease or cold or other things. But anyway, she does get out, and the bishop, quote, forbade her to continue to be involved in making such invocations on pain of being returned to prison. So this is directly from the register of the Châtelet of Meaux. And what we're seeing here is that the witchcraft they're talking about, making invocations. So again, this is folk magic, you know, and not at all necessary to assume that this is harmful magic, which is, of course, the position of church and state both. This is all forbidden. No female is supposed to be presiding neither in medicine nor in religious ceremony by their books. But much worse awaited her than that 1 year in jail. And pretty soon after she's released, officials in a Parisian criminal court produce a sworn statement by Jean de Rilly. And he claims that Jean de Brigue was a devine, so this is literally a diviner, but this is a name for witch in this period, close to 1400. And he says that she had used sorcery to heal him. So what we see happening increasingly is that even beneficial magic is still actionable in court. You can still be burned for it. And Jean de Rilly says that she had lifted a spell off of him cast by Gillette, who was the mother of his two illegitimate children. So they're not married. He has a girlfriend. Now, Jean herself, Jean de Brigue, was at that time a 34-year-old woman, and she was known about town as La Cordière. Now, I'm not really sure the nuances of this in French. It sounds like it means something like she of the rope or cord, and this could have could describe her as a rope maker. It could refer also to the time-honored practice of tying knots in cords, and this is what in Latin the canon lawyers called ligatura or knotting. These were kinds of spells that we know were used in contraception magic and also in the magic of causing male impotence. And so this is exactly the spell for which Rilly had sought a cure. So the healing that he's seeking is to have his impotence lifted. And Jean, of course, denies this sorcery accusation. And she was prudently claiming to the court that she only used orthodox prayers in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. So you would be under suspicion, more suspicion, if you were using anything that had a pagan tinge to it. And so Catholic prayers here, she's trying to say, look, you know, I'm devout, and, you know, I would never use anything that you priests disagree with or disapprove of. But even those who did use these charms, and we see this in Spain, Italy, France, lots of places, that still could not protect you. So that, you know, even chanting prayers would be considered illegitimate, because if you weren't instructed to do this by a priest, then too bad for you. You're under suspicion, and this terrible things can be done to you. So she's in jail, and her trial is, the trial of La Cordière is delayed for 3 months. So she had lots of time to ponder her best strategy for release or escaping the torture. And so finally, the judges confront her with her previous imprisonment for sorcery in Mull. And this is the pattern again, is that once you have been accused before, your likelihood of being accused and tried and convicted later is increased. So Jeanne de Bligue ends up agreeing that she had spoken with a demon. It doesn't say anything about her being tortured, but we can imagine from the other cases that was going on. And, you know, they're literally, their body is in the hands of their enemies in these prisons with, you know, jailer rape and all the rest of that, not on the record. And so she offers this demon a payment in hemp seeds and ashes, which is kind of interesting, you know, that marijuana seeds there. And so the provost sentenced her to be burned. And Jeanne manages through a scheme to postpone her execution by feigning that she was pregnant. This was always a surefire way to delay execution because of, you know, the ban on, you know, fine to kill the mother, not so great if there's a baby in there. And so they discover her ruse, and she then appeals to Parlement, to the legislature, and succeeds in getting her trial reopened, which is already by itself pretty impressive to get that much to happen. But unfortunately for her, the court responds with an order for her to be tortured. And this too has a long history. I mean, we can see this all the way going back to Greek and Roman jurisprudence, the idea that people of low status especially could be tortured as a judicial procedure, or even must be tortured, as we see in the Greek, ancient Greek custom. So we can see that the officials of the Châtelet were determined to get a confession, which would be damning enough to burn her. That was really their agenda. And that's what the torture is for, is to get her to say what they want. So Jeanne is clearly terrified. She tells the judges that Massette, the wife of Rouilly, this guy that accused her, had requested her to put a spell on her husband. So now they arrest Massette. And she too is threatened with torture, and she too confesses quickly. And maybe the fame of Margot de la Barre's useless resistance had spread in Paris. I mean, everybody kind of knew what was going on. And so once you're in their hands, then, you know, not much to help you. So Massette tells a story that she had gotten Rouilly to marry her by using a special ointment. And the couple afterwards moved to the village of Guérard, and for 4 years, they ran a tavern inn there together. So now I'm going to read you a little piece, because this is so rare to find, from the transcript of the Châtelet trial. During that time, between her and her said husband, there were numerous quarrels and arguments, as much because her said husband abused and beat her because she didn't want to do and carry out his wishes, as because she answered him very harshly and sharply, telling him that she was as good as her said husband was, for which thing he led her a very bad and hard life, beating her as often as not. And so she, seeing that in no way could she stay with her said husband because of the beatings that he gave her, remembering and considering part of the things told to her by her aforesaid female neighbors of Rouilly in Anjou, that she had found to be true, and wanting to try and know if the other things here written above, told by them to her, might also be equally true, on a certain day she does not recall, she being alone in her room at the inn at the said place of Guérard, her aforesaid husband absent and about his business, she called three times, one after the other, prayed and requested the aforesaid Luciafer to help her put her husband in such a state that never in this world could he beat or abuse her who spoke. So that's all one sentence, and this is pretty typical of the legalese of the time. Make it sound pompous. And so she continues giving an account of how she repeated Paternostas and Ave Marias while molding a wax image, simmering it and poking it with a knife. And Every time she did this, supposedly, this is all torture testimony, it caused Rouillet to fall sick and experience pains. This confession bears a lot of resemblance to other witch testimony under the threat of torture, calling on the devil and so on, even though she's really trying to put through a little Catholic content there about the Paternosters just to make it look like she really isn't so bad. But of course, that's not much help for her. And we get more of a realistic ring when Massette talks about her unhappy marriage to this tavern keeper and the battering with alcoholic overtones. And also her reference to women neighbors advising and teaching her sorcery for marriage situations. This is intriguing. You know, this is like a hint of a whole underground female community of advice and strategies in dealing with a very asymmetrical power relationship of husband and wife in medieval law. He could beat her. That was okay with church and state. You know, you're allowed. And I talked about that in the last episode. So the poor two women there, Jeanne de Pligue, the accused witch, and Massette Rouillet, the abused wife, sat in jail for 2 weeks awaiting sentencing, while the lawyers were arguing over whether church courts or city courts had jurisdiction over their case. But that was, to them, not really of much importance because all but one judge agreed that both of the women should be burned at the stake. So finally, there's a ruling from Parlement, and they upheld the secular court's right to decide the case. And this is following the royal policy of claiming state authority over sorcery cases. And I talk about this elsewhere in this volume, The Sorcery Charge, because there were turf battles over secular and religious officials over, because there was confiscated property to be at stake in many cases. But in any case, the secular court. And so Rouillet had a last opportunity to save his wife and the woman he said had cured him when the court questioned him one last time. And he admitted he had never seen his wife try to poison him, but he claimed that two toads were recently found and killed in his courtyard. So, you know, these would be considered emissaries sent by the witches. And he offered additional evidence in the form of herbs, wood, hair, and wax. So this really looks like an abuser is trying to get rid of his wife by bringing these accusations against them, her. And, you know, by bringing all this evidence in. So, you know, he was giving the judges what they wanted, and they were very happy to convict in ways that were convenient for him. This is in a society where divorce is not legal. And so this is a pathway to him to get rid of Massette. So we see the provost sentencing Jeanne and Massette to appear in the marketplace pillory, wearing sorcerer's mitres. So this is part of the upgrowth of persecutory culture. They had to wear these hats, pointed hats, that were declaring them as witches. And this happens, this public humiliation happens in 1391. And right after that, they're taken to the swine market and they are burned at the stake in the same spot where Jeanne d'Abbauton and her company of poverty disciples had been executed for heresy 20 years before. So this is just a continuity of place, the place of execution. And you have to wonder if Jean Rouillet was present there watching with his friends. For one thing, we know that he was now free to marry his mistress. So really, the sorcery charge in this case provided a ready means of getting rid of a wife that he no longer wanted. So, but the thing is, if Gillette had inflicted his impotence, as Rouillet told the court, this is his mistress, and La Cordière had treated him for it successfully, then why did he accuse her? Why did he not accuse Gillette? And why did he not defend Massette, his wife, who hadn't, you know, done this? But instead, he testifies against his wife and implicates her as a witch. The municipal court does not question his accusations or motivations at all. if we look at the accusation, the key, the pivotal thing that this all starts with, the removal of a sexual impotence spell by La Cordière harks all the way back to the Salic laws against Nuit-la-Guillette, as it became known, the tying of magical knots to cause impotence. La Guillette, this is the ties that the breeches, the leggings attached to the belt or to the codpiece. So it was very much tied together in the popular mind with male potency. And this method that we see described in the trial of throwing herbs and powders underfoot of the target, like Marion and Margot were said to have done, was widely used, as we also see from trials of the Spanish Inquisition. We see churchman Arnaldo de Villanova writing about other favorite methods, splitting a nut or acorn in half, then placing the halves on opposite sides of the path of a bridal couple. Or for maximum results, the sorceress would place three or four enchanted beans under their bed on the road or about the door. But this old charge of ligatura, which we find in earlier sources, was still alive in the minds of the priesthood. So we see a lot of attention devoted to this subject by 13th century canon law. There's something from the decretals of Gregory IX, who became pope, of frigid and bewitched persons and impotence in intercourse. And Thomas Aquinas gave added weight to this concept of impotence caused by sorcery. And he reproved disbelief in it. So you had to believe it was possible. This is all being underlined by the theologians. And so as the tales of demonologists circulated, you have male fear of witches mounting to delusional proportions. And that is something that continued over the following centuries. A lot of the trial records refer, there's a lot of sexual obsession in what the women are forced to talk about in the torture trials, you know, and there's orgies and there's pornography, demonological pornography about painful sex or the huge member of the devil or the cold, icy member of the devil. And so, you know, there's this whole dynamic which really hasn't been given due attention to the way that the pornographic obsessions of the torturers, of the judges, of the accusers are played out on the bodies of these women in the dungeons, and how the women are forced to parrot back these fantasies. You know, so there's this very twisted thing going on there. And there is a way in which this happening over the course of centuries during the entire witch craze that marked European culture in very profound ways. First with misogyny, you know, the whole woman-hating aspect of it, the construction of women as a terrible threat, harm to men being the obsession primarily. And there are other themes that come in there, including the already existing demonology that featured black devils. The devil as an Ethiopian, as an African, had been around for a long time already. By the 1300s, had been around for, you know, at least eight centuries in Europe. And so that demonization of blackness combined with these rape fantasies of devils raping witches or witches being sexually enslaved by the devils, those two become fused in these pornographic torture narratives forced out of the mouths of these female captives in the dungeons. And this is one place where we're seeing the genesis of the myth of the black rapist in European consciousness before the period of the slave trade, before the period even of the European conquest. So this is important to see the way that the repression of female power as witches, female resistance inside marriage from abuse or from being deserted by men who leave a woman for another woman, all these different dynamics that women are subject to. That combines and intertwines with racialized demonologies. And I'm going to have a lot more to say about that in future podcasts as we get into the 14, 15, 1600s and on, later than that. But the racialized script is very much bound up together with the misogynist script. And, you know, the woman hating is primary in these witch trials. That's the reason why you have this overwhelming majority of the accused being women, and even more than that, of those tried being women, and even more than that, of those convicted being women. So, you know, at every point along the line, there is this projection of magical harm doing on women, very strong infusion of sexual politics and male authority and all of those things being played out. So I know this is a grisly subject, but, you know, I see all of this at the roots of Western civ and the way that female speech and female ritual power or the possibility of women being healers, being attacked, and those women becoming targets, vulnerable to persecution, to iron and fire through a torture and the stake. And so we have to digest this because this is the prehistory of modern Western civilization and very much involving legacies of going after women, targeting women. So that's what I've got for you today. If you like this podcast, you can throw a donation over on my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/maxdashu, M-A-X-D-A-S-H-U. Other podcasts are coming fast and thick now there. And also visit my website at suppresshistories.net. And there is a section there, excerpts, some written excerpts from some of the chapters in the series Secret History of the Witches. Thank you for listening, and till next time.